Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. And we're literally helping you focus on what we have as a government. We're giving you... These are the principal founding documents, folks. However anybody has stated or editorialized differently, they have no intention of giving you the truth. But when you read these documents, now we understand what happened, what's going on, and it helps us dispel the myths. It helps us dispel, you know, these mysteries of, you know, there was this undercurrent from this activity or that. And no, don't buy into it. Read these things for yourself. We're reading it and we're putting the documents up. So there's no reason why when you listen to our shows, you don't pull these documents up for yourself and read through them with us and go, oh my gosh, they are not inserting anything. They're not omitting anything. And if you question the documents I'm providing you, I'm giving you the link to where you can find the source document to prove I didn't even alter the text at all. I don't have anything to hide. Because I believe the truth is what, one, we all need, because this is what we can unite on, is the truth. And secondly... with the truth, we are empowered to be able to take back our governments, because I'm going to prove this to you, because we ended last year with the process of doing that. So we go through this whole curriculum every year to help you understand that this is not about entertainment. This is not about partisanship. It's not about vengeance. It's not about the crap that's happening around the world. This is about taking back the government that we were bestowed with by the divine hand of providence. He gave us everything we needed. Only he knew where we would be as a nation. And only he knew that we would literally be at the cusp of our doom our demise. There you go. I knew it was a double D. So anyway, welcome back, Sean. Welcome back. And so...
Thank you.
So, Sean... you mentioned prior to, and I knew you were going to bring this up, because every time they referred to these gentlemen as esquires, they kept on calling them esquires. Well, what did an esquire mean? Do you know what an esquire is?
I think they're like sworn to some kind of collective oath.
Well,
all I really know is it refers to people who are practicing attorneys or lawyers.
Yes, it is a title of nobility. But these titles being bestowed upon them, these titles were, you know, originally, you know, a byproduct of the English lawyer legal education. When they broke away from England, they did not maintain its association to the British accredited registry. Even though these men were granted this title of nobility, they no longer had this affinity with the bar. The states recognized that these men were practicing and/or recognized with this title of nobility a person of law, educated of the law. Which didn't make him necessarily any better. It was just a title of nobility. So the states kind of maintained this. And so the states maintained the education system, but they were not educating based on the bar or bringing people under the bar, which is when we read the Constitution, this concept of a title of nobility cannot be granted by a foreign polity or foreign potent, you know, prince, king, what have you. That when we get into the 13th Amendment, that's when they started seeing lawyers coming into America from England that were actual, you know, seeking to become citizens and still practicing under the British Esquire title, that title of nobility that was granted to them from the king. And they said, hey, we got a problem with that because those people are not loyal to this Constitution. So they actually created an amendment that said anybody that is carrying the Esquire title that has been granted that, if they've been granted that, whether they like it or not, they come here, they cannot be a citizen of the United States. That's what the 13th Amendment stated. Now, you can be an Esquire from the state of Virginia. You can be an Esquire from the state of, at that point in time, Louisiana. Because you were bestowed upon that from the state, not a foreign potent sovereign, you know, king, what have you. That was a local title of nobility. So the whole point of the 13th Amendment was any ties of titles of nobility coming from foreign sources. So does that help? Does that make sense?
Yeah, it explains it, but I still don't understand how. So basically these persons swore some oath of allegiance to the crown regarding the law.
Uh-huh.
And now were they required to denounce that or renounce that or advocate it? I mean, I don't understand how said, oh, well, now it doesn't really mean anything. It's just, you know, a fancy word we like. You swore an oath to the crown, mm-hmm. and now you're the core people building the new government, and, you know, the government is denying any person, any that's, you know, sworn allegiance to a foreign potentate, then I don't understand how this was like just glossed over.
Right, so it wasn't glossed over. As a matter of fact, after the Revolution, anybody that supported the British crown was deported. They were called Tories. And all Tories, anybody that had any favorable thing towards the king, his government, his laws, and so forth, they purged themselves of those ranks. There were people that maintained those titles, but their titles and their loyalty was towards liberty and the Union. Now, what happened over time, because the deportation began in the 1783, and it probably went for probably about a year of, you know, casting these folks out. And in that process of casting these folks out, you know, we started moving forward. Well, they maintained these titles of nobility, and because at that point in time, everybody kind of expunged themselves and purged any and all types of allegiances to the crown. Therefore, as we kind of look at, you know, everything moving forward, they didn't see a threat until immigration and people coming in with that title of nobility from England who were not proven loyalists to the Constitution and to the Union. So they all of a sudden realized there was a need for an amendment to basically say anybody that is maintaining a title of nobility that is coming from the British crown, i.e. the Esquire under the bar, those folks are going to be banned of citizenship. They cannot be a citizen. Okay, does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it makes sense in explaining what happened, but I don't understand why they wouldn't just completely eradicate that, the title. How can you have a title of nobility but say, oh, but I'm not, you know, aligned with that. I just used the name. And that's like saying, oh, well, I'm king.
Okay, so
not really a king. I just call myself king.
Okay, so if you read the 13th Amendment, the 13th Amendment literally clarified it. Okay, so let me go to the 13th Amendment and read this. And unfortunately, I'm in a state where I don't have the navigation pane, so give me a second to kind of go through this. All right. The 13th Amendment right here. that was proposed and proposed in 1810 and ratified 1812, that any citizen of the United States shall accept, claim, receive, or retain any title of nobility or honor, or shall, without the consent of Congress, accept and retain any present pension, office, or emolument of any kind whatever from any emperor, king, prince, or foreign power, such person shall cease to be a citizen of the United States and shall be incapable of holding any office of trust or profit under them or either of them. Boom. Does that make sense now?
Oh, yeah, I get it, and I totally agree with that. Okay. I still don't understand why they're maintained the Esquire. It's right there in red and yellow.
It's, okay, so it's just a general term. The question is, what is the source of the title of nobility? Is it from the state of Louisiana? It's okay. If it's from the state of New York, it's okay. If it's from Harvard, it's okay. If it's from a foreign state or, you know, anything like that, then it's not okay.
Okay. So all this hullabaloo about all lawyers are loyal to the British crown is a misnomer.
No. So the reason the 13th Amendment was written was they already saw the British lawyers and the bar starting to form in America again. Mm-hmm. Now, 1810 was prior to the what happened in 1812?
The War of 1812.
There you go. And looky here. In 1812, the 13th Amendment was ratified. Do you think Britain liked the idea that we just basically pulled the plug on any of their the lawyers that they had in here, that they were going to undermine us by practicing law and literally starting to pervert us via our legal system? We just killed them. We killed their ability to do that. And they said, doggone those guys, they got us again. So they attacked us and tried to wage war with us. And then they realized that they could not project enough force to take us out. We had way too many people in America by that point in time. They just couldn't occupy and literally control us. The only way you can win a war is when you can take, you know, the spoils of war and take full control. There's no way they could sit here and occupy us. We would just leave them and kill them through attrition. They'd keep on having to replace the people we would be killing because they couldn't just take away our guns. They just couldn't go door to door. We were too massive of a nation. I mean, the state of New York, I believe, is bigger than the entire British Isles.
Right.
And so how's this little teeny state going to have that many people to come into New York, Virginia? I mean, by this point in time in 1812, I think even Florida was a part of the Union and Louisiana. So we were becoming so monstrous that they realized after the War of 1812, they weren't going to win that way. They had to really go to subversive measures. And for the most part, they started infiltrating us with corporations, with banks, and these types of things, along with technologies and actual
education.
And so one of the things that is interesting is we didn't necessarily recognize patents from other nations, and we created our own patents for limited times. So when we created like our own railroads, there was this patent in Europe that basically said that these railroads, but the patent, because when we patented the railroads, I believe we adjusted the gauge of the width of the railroad to make it so that we had a different patent. And the cotton gin was a stolen technology from Eli Whitney. There were lots of things that we were stealing from England. In their technologies and their manufacturings and so forth, we were having a heyday re-engineering and doing better at it. And so they were having real problems of trying to, you know, get up on us. So the best way they could get up on us was to start coming and creating these corporations with their backing. So this is where we start seeing in the 1820s and on, where they bring money in, they bring people in to become citizens, because you couldn't be a foreign person to own and operate a foreign corporation in the United States, in any of the states. You had to be a citizen. And so they came in and started infiltrating us that way, with the intent of having this loyalty and that the profits would be going back to Britain or what have you. So that they were working in undermining us. And as a matter of fact, Britain at this point in time wasn't too worried about the profits coming back. They were more worried about growing and growing and having better affluence and influence in the United States. And therefore, they were working and working. Ultimately, they created the American Bar Association. What is the American Bar Association? Well, it is the American British Accredited Registry. It is a foreign entity. It's a local foreign entity. Anywho. So
how can those people who are part of the bar serve in the government?
Oh, well, so what ended up happening with the 13th Amendment was, as the bar was doing this, they were expunging it. This is why when you read the Constitution, you don't see that amendment anymore. They made it go away. They didn't repeal it. They just basically started changing the alterations of history and deleted anything that referred to it that they could get their hands on. And so most of the people of the United States have no clue that 13th Amendment was, they know, oh, well, there was an amendment out there, but it was never properly ratified, because that's the narrative today that they're hiding and helping people say, oh, well, yeah, it was never ratified. It wasn't properly ratified. Well, we actually have primary source documents that prove otherwise. So as we move forward with Republic Review, the 13th Amendment will come back. It will be recognized as a ratified amendment. So in so doing, we'll be able to actually create that protection again from foreign courts and foreign entanglements within our legal system. Anyway, I don't want to digress too much, but I did want to cover that, because I do realize that this causes headaches for people, because, well, hold it. You're saying the 13th Amendment was ratified, but it's not in the Constitution. What happened? There's all of these lingering questions. On my website, on the Constitutional Articles page, I'm pretty sure you'll find a document called the Compiled Laws of Wyoming. I'm told that this is in other similar documents from Colorado and other states that joined the Union around that time. But in the Compiled Laws of Wyoming, because this was done in the early 1870s, they actually included the original 13th Amendment. But because at this point in time, and in 1871, Britain successfully undermined and got rid of the radical Republicans who passed the 14th Amendment. And so Congress tried in 1871 to redefine the 14th Amendment. This is important because John Bingham, the author of the Privileges and Immunities Clause, because this is when the federal government says, yeah, hold on here. That Privileges and Immunities Clause, which basically states, no state shall make or enforce any law that abridges the privileges or immunities of a citizen of the United States. Well, that clause actually was a sweeping clause, because it applied every privilege and immunity that was guaranteed by the U.S. Constitution to be protected. The people were to be protected from their states from passing laws that would violate them. In other words, it applied the Bill of Rights. Well, they were redefining this 4 years after Congress sent it out. They were already trying to redefine it. John Bingham was one of the guys. He authored it, and he was one of the few people that remained in Congress before Britain was able to unseat him from his political House of Representatives seat. And so I had the document, you know, we have the congressional record where the speaker was basically, they were trying to redefine that, that it wasn't sweeping, that the Bill of Rights only pertained to the federal government. John Bingham got up and said, "Sir, that is not true. The whole intent of that was to ensure," and he basically in his comment back, he said, "That applies to all of the amendments of the Bill of Rights and all privileges and immunities within the Constitution." I'm paraphrasing, but he literally said that that does apply to the Bill of Rights. And so, you know, he clarified, he was the author of that, and he was the one that clarified that. When we go through the debates in Congress of the 14th Amendment, the only negative things that we were finding were the ones of those few people that voted against it. For the most part, the 14th Amendment was a redo on guess what? The Civil Rights Act of 1866. In January of 1866, Congress passed the Civil Rights Act of 1866, and it was vetoed by President Andrews. Andrew Johnson. And so Andrew Johnson vetoed it. Well, Congress, boom, went back in and they, with two-thirds majorities, simply overpowered his veto, boom. And they said, "Take that. You know, you think you're laughing at us? We're enforcing this." And he laughed and said, "An act is not enforceable in any of the states. It doesn't matter what you think you just did. You just created, you know, ink on paper that is not executable in the states. It must be an amendment." Well, guess what Congress did? They took that Civil Rights Act and they converted it into an amendment, and then they started adding things to it. But the privileges and immunities was a part of that Civil Rights Act. So they had already kind of debated the privileges and immunities in the Civil Rights Act of 1866. And actually, that was coming forth in 1865 because the Civil Rights Act was something that Lincoln wanted. And Lincoln wanted to just, instead of amend the Constitution, he wanted an act. And we were going to ram this down everybody's throat because that's the kind of tyrant he was. But Johnson was correct. And this, I believe, was divine intervention as well. Because at this point in time, they still had the quote-unquote radical Republicans still had such a majority that they knew they could get away with actually getting the amendment out their door. So they said, "Well, what do we have to lose? Let's do this." And they got it out the door, out to the states for ratification. And in the process, shortly after they got it out, like 3-4 months later, in New Orleans, the great massacre occurred of the 200 some odd black freemen who were killed. You've probably heard about that, right?
Yes, sir. I've heard a lot of that horrible history.
Yes.
In fact, where I live, like a couple of blocks from me, is one of the historical slave uprisings.
Yes. Okay, great. So as we look at what happened, this is when in August of 1866, there were 200 some odd blacks who were looking to get organized politically, that they wanted to start running for office, obtaining representation, and actually changing the makeup of the politics of Louisiana. This was perceived as a huge threat to the power base of the status quo. And therefore, the government, the law enforcement, sheriffs, and so forth, along with other civilians, went in with guns into that convention and killed them all. That right there became an indictment of how bad the South needed that clause, the privileges and immunities clause of the 14th Amendment. Now, we're going to be going into break in just a second here. So when we come back, we can kind of close on this. Because, you know, this is very important history. Because at this point in time, we were still safe from England. And, you know, every time you know, England lashes back out at us, it's because we really poke or kick them in the teeth. And so we'll go into the 14th Amendment of how that happened and why England got committed. We'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so let's kind of wrap this up. As we look at the 14th Amendment, I said going into the break that we really kicked England in the teeth. Most people do not know this, and most people have completely perverted every little aspect of the 14th Amendment, because what they're trying to do is they're trying to make a situation where government can be tyrannical in America without the 14th Amendment protection. The 14th Amendment protection keeps state governments from being able to oppress us. There is no other mechanism other than the state constitutions that your states are already walking and dancing. As a matter of fact, metaphorically speaking, I, in a previous conversation today, in a mentoring meeting, I talked about the state constitution and how your state government is not only crossing the line, as well as the federal government. It seems like everybody in government has learned the toe-kicking dance that is done by, the river dance or whatever? You know, the Irish? You ever seen that?
River dance.
Yeah, the river dance. Okay. They're not only walking across the line, they're dancing arrogantly on top of that line, around the line, over the line, and everywhere they will go. In other words, they're literally flaunting in our face that nothing in the Constitution matters because you don't know it and you don't understand it, and they're going to take every bit advantage of you because of that. That's how arrogant they have gotten. And I mean, if there is, to me, you know, it's a very proudful dance. Right? It's very upright, very rigid. And to me, it's there are all sorts of dances out there where, you know, the whole design is, you know, kind of the capturing of nature, where the flaunting of beauty, the flaunting of power. And the river dance is a perfect metaphor for how government is dancing on that line, going across it, you know, with this loud fury and flurry of feet. you working with me on this?
I'm with you, brother.
Okay, so as we kind of look at the 14th Amendment, Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, we understand to be so critical because this is where we actually have this thing called, I'll call it the accountability. There is nowhere in the Constitution where we can actually start holding these public servants accountable other than in the 14th Amendment, Section 3. That's why this one amendment is so critical. But the amendment of Section 4 in the same amendment was the true kick in the teeth. I'll read it for you. The validity of the public debt of the United States authorized by law, including debts incurred for payment of pensions and bounties for services in suppressing the insurrection or rebellion shall not be questioned. In other words, everything we had to do to bring these states back, right, wrong, or indifferent, they exceeded their power. But this right here basically says what we had to do in offering these pensions, these payments, and so forth, cannot be questioned. Our debts cannot be questioned. But neither the United States nor any state shall assume or assume to pay any debt or obligation incurred in the aid of the insurrection or rebellion against the United States, or any claim of loss or emancipation of any slave, but all such debts, obligations, and claims shall be held illegal and void. Now, we already know that reparations is basically when you kind of create a law that makes something legal, and then you declare it, you take away the legality of slavery and say that now slavery is illegal. You can't go after people who are practicing slavery before while it was legal. They have the protection of the law. Right, wrong, or indifferent, the whole point of our system is to ensure we get government right, and the mechanism of doing that is in the process of amending the Constitution. It was wrong, so we had to amend the Constitution to get rid of it. We did that. Moving forward, it is now illegal, and you will be subject to whatever the consequences are for violating the federal law or the Constitution. Now, the Whiskey Rebellion, that was considered treason. Therefore, anybody that was practicing slavery after the 14th Amendment and after, because it was passed, and after this whole, I think, the 13th Amendment, and basically emancipating all slaves. Okay, so now we have it. But the reality was that these states left the Union. The southern states were not a part of the Union, and they were not being allowed to just ratify or refuse to reject the 14th Amendment. In other words, when the 14th Amendment went out to the Union, the number of for the 3/4 was based upon the northern states. The southern states were not a part of that equation. Why? Because they did leave the Union. As much as Lincoln tried to cover it up with his tyranny, they seceded. They were no longer representing and seeking representation in the federal government, even up to after the war. So why would the southern states want to come back into the Union? Sean, do you have any idea why the southern states needed the protection of the Union immediately after the 14th Amendment?
Because they seceded and now they were conquered territory. And well, if they could get their status back as states, then they could have some form of protection against being dissolved.
Well, so they may have been conquered, but the U.S. Constitution does not empower the government to colonize conquered land. It could be territory and so forth. But if the good people of that land do not want to be admitted back into the Union, then they could actually seek to be expunged. They could actually seek statehood with Mexico. Does that make sense? They couldn't seek statehood with Britain or any Europe because we, by this point in time, we had the Monroe Doctrine. So, but they could actually align and say, we would rather seek statehood with Mexico or Canada or what have you, something that's a Western Hemisphere, because the Constitution does not allow the federal government to inflict and enforce people to join the Union or states to join the Union. But I'm telling you, the 14th Amendment motivated them so much that they saw it was the irresistible object. They could not ratify and come into the Union and ratify the 14th Amendment. As much as they hated everything, Section 4 was what protected them from having to pay that debt, because it stated, but neither the United States nor any state shall assume or assume to pay any obligation to, you know, that aided the insurrection. So if they join the Union, they're now a part of the Union and not obligated to fulfill that debt or to pay that debt back.
Oh, okay, I get it. So now, like if they got loans or aid from a foreign country.
Like Britain, who was basically, they put themselves so fine, they were so financially vested in destroying America that they really put it on the line. And this right here was a pure kick in the teeth to Britain. The fourth.
Yeah, now they're not getting their money back.
That's right. Now they can't get their money back. Now what's Britain going to do? So what Britain had to do when this ratified, because Britain was sitting there going, this isn't going to fly. This ain't going to fly. And when they saw that it actually was ratified in 1868, they started pouring money into the 1868 election, and they had hardly a debt. But they kept on pouring money into these candidates who were basically beholden to the Britain holding investors. They didn't know. But all they knew, because I think some of these guys, they just didn't know. Some did know and helped convince others to get on board without truly knowing. They just lied and deceived them. But they wanted to get rid of the radical Republicans because the justification was they wanted to make sure that, you know, blacks would never have the status that they should have in America. And so because what was, believe it or not, what they were seeing in the North as many blacks were getting very smart to the Reconstruction crap, they said, I'm getting out of here. I'm not going to be basically take money where I become dependent on government. Then they stop paying me. So many of the blacks, the freemen, started leaving, and they migrated up to Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, and places like that, which is why there's large concentrations from that migration, that initial migration, just to get out of there, to have, you know, to get their own land and to be able to say, you know, oh, I'm doing this, and we're going to do this on our own. And ergo, they weren't entitled to the Reconstruction, you know, help and so forth. All of a sudden, these other states said, hey, you know, they're coming here. As a matter of fact, Thomas Sowell talks about this in Black Rednecks and White Liberals. As much as some of the white states were, you know, doing the right thing in ratifying the 14th Amendment, there were three states, Oregon being the outlier, but if I remember correctly, I know Ohio was one of them, because Ohio was actually seeing an increase in black freemen coming into the state, seeking, you know, the ability to rent and so forth. And the people that were being denied the rent and so forth, believe it or not, weren't the blacks coming up. It was the whites that were coming up with the blacks. Anyway, so it's kind of an eye-opening thing to see this mass migration and so forth. But these states literally started drawing these lines of saying, or these three states said, you know what, we need to rescind our ratification. And therefore, as they kind of move forward, you know, after the 14th Amendment, three states tried to change their ratification. The federal government said that mechanism is not in that constitutional amendment. Ergo, you cannot undo the ratification. It is a one-way door. Because had they actually allowed that, then the 14th Amendment could have actually been undone. And at that point in time, that was solved before 1871, because these three states actually started challenging or going back in 1868. And by that point in time, the radical Republicans were still in control, and they didn't allow that to move forward, if that makes sense. Does that make sense? Yeah, no, maybe so.
Yes, sir.
So, moving forward, let's dive into New Hampshire, because that's where we kind of left off. And you can kind of pick it up with the and whereas. Actually, it starts off with whereas the formation of the federal compact. So New Hampshire, and if you look, this is 27 June. This is after the convention had already met. So this is an after-the-fact appointments. But let's go ahead and read through this. It'll be a couple paragraphs before we get down to the empowerment. But there we go. Okay?
Whereas in the formation of the Federal Compact, which frames the bond of union of the American states, It was not possible in the infant state of our republic to devise a system which in the course of time and experience would not manifest imperfections that it would be necessary to reform. And whereas the limited powers which by the Articles of Confederation are vested in the Congress of the United States have been far inadequate to the enlarged purposes which they were intended to produce. And whereas Congress hath, by repeated and most urgent representations, endeavored to awaken this and other states of the Union to a sense of the truly critical and alarming situation in which they may inevitably be involved unless timely measures be taken to enlarge the power of our Congress, that they may thereby be enabled to avert the dangers which threaten our existence as a free and independent people. And whereas this state had been ever desirous to act upon the liberal system of the general good of the United States without circumscribing its views to the narrow and selfish objects of partial convenience, and has been at all times ready to make every concession to the safety and happiness of the whole, which justice and sound policy could vindicate, be it therefore enacted by the Senate and House of Representatives and General Court convened, that John Langdon, John Pickering, Nicholas Gilman, and Benjamin West Esquires be and hereby are appointed commissioners. They or any two of them are hereby authorized and empowered as deputies from this state to meet at Philadelphia said convention or any other place to which the said convention may be adjourned for the purposes aforesaid, there to confer with such deputies as are or may be appointed by other state by the other states for similar purposes, and with them to discuss and decide upon the most effectual means to remedy the defects of our federal union and to procure and secure the enlarged purposes which it was intended to effect, and to report such an act to the United States and Congress as when agreed to by them and duly confirmed by the several states will effectually provide for the same.
All right, so interesting. A little bit longer. I mean, they kind of got a little wordy. They just wasn't rubber stamping. But for the most part, they were pretty much very interested in saving the Union, very interested in enlarging the powers, and pretty much, is it fair to say, another rubber stamp. Go do what's necessary. Okay. So currently, with this, we now have New Hampshire, North Carolina, Maryland, Massachusetts, Georgia, Delaware, and Connecticut with, you know, go do what's necessary with only two states out of the five, right? Is that five? One, two, three, four, five, six, seven out of the seven. So two states out of the seven had minor stipulations that had nothing to do with what we were told, that this was a runaway convention. Now, to be honest, folks, not that I lie at all, but when you look at the ratification debates, the Federalists, or I should say the Anti-Federalists, only pulled this crap of this violation of the commission in these larger states. And when we get to Virginia, because the one state I know they actually had an election to determine whether they violated their commission or not, and having read the commission from the state legislature, they said, are you kidding me? And the delegates voted in favor of moving forward that they did not violate their commission. Well, you know, why are these bad arguments growing legs just because it sounds good? It just baffles me. When the amount of documentation that we have, that anybody could do the due diligence to prove a false argument out there, like this was a runaway convention, what makes somebody think that they could create this irrefutable argument that it was a runaway convention when the documentation doesn't support it?
They have ulterior motives.
There you go. And they're banking on the fact that you will trust them blindly and not do the due diligence, because these are good people. They're godly men, for heaven's sakes, right? We wouldn't question or impugn their character Why would they do such a thing? And so there we go. I mean, if you think about it, when you have that level of power where the people give you blind trust, the party has that, right? The majority of the people blindly vote based on party affiliation than anything else. Don't tell me that we're not sheeple. There are people that actually do get to the truth. I'm just amazed that, because I'm not an advocate for the Convention of States, but I'm just amazed that this argument has still continued in this dialogue. If I was the Convention of State folks, I would kill that argument altogether to say, you can't say that the first one was a runaway convention, so because your logical deduction is this one has to be one as well. But the real problem, because just so you know, folks, is, Sean, is the Article 5 Convention in the Constitution? I know I asked you this before. It's there, right? It's right there in Article 5, and a process of how to convene a convention. It's in the Constitution.
Yes, sir.
Stating it differently, now putting it into Article 3 context, the Article 5 Convention arises under this Constitution, correct?
Yes.
Yes. So when the jurisdiction of the court states that the federal or the Supreme Court of the United States shall have jurisdiction, I'm just paraphrasing, over all things arising under this Constitution, if there becomes a dispute or if Congress seeks to seize control over the Article 5 Convention, who has the jurisdiction authority to adjudicate and determine the outcome of whether they have that authority or not?
The states.
The Supreme Court. Because it's literally, it arises under the Constitution. So let me, because this is important, because I like going through these arguments. And when we read Article 3, Section 2, it states this: the judicial power shall extend to all cases in law. So the law being Article 5 is the supreme law of the land and equity arising under this Constitution, the laws of the United States and treaties made which shall be made under their authority. So in other words, Article 5 arising under the Constitution, the judicial power is extended to that. So when Congress basically says, hey, we don't want to, we're going to allow you to call, because this is what I would do if I was Congress. If the convention came up to where they passed it, Congress could easily play this to say, we're going to call forth the convention. We want the convention to be held right here in the District of Columbia. This is going to be your venue, and we're going to set the terms to, the state of California will have 90 delegates, the state of Delaware will have one, blah, 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 and we won't vote by delegations. We're going to vote by delegates. In other words, a popular vote. They're going to start creating rules to literally change the makeup of that convention and how that convention is going to function. Congress can literally, basically, in calling forth the convention, call forth the standards and what they're going to do and so forth. What's going to happen is the states are going to push back and say, no, we're not doing that. And then Congress will basically say, hey, this arises under the Constitution. We're calling you. You've asked for this, and now we're demanding you provide us delegates for this amount of delegates to come to this convention. And the federal government, I believe, is going to pay for it because it arises under the Constitution. They have to pay for it, so it's going to go to D.C. They're going to have the control over this. This is what boggles everybody's minds. They can't do that. They won't do that. Hold on here. Why is it that you want to have a convention in the first place? Oh, yeah, that's right. Because of the magnitude of federal overreach. And you're telling me that this is so sacred they won't overreach on this issue?
Right.
Okay. So, I mean, this is, it's like, who do they think they're arguing with? I understand that there's a lot of illiteracy. There's a lot of people that just don't do the due diligence. Not even the John Birchers are bringing up this argument. because, oh, well, they've already kind of agreed to whatever documentation before. It doesn't matter what they did before. This is a new Congress, and Congress can actually do whatever they want. It's a new Supreme Court, and they're making it up as they go along. And I'm telling you that the Supreme Court would probably rule in favor of Congress. I wouldn't want to take that chance. I think the calling
That's
for
terrifying.
What's that?
I said it's terrifying.
Yeah.
The thought of the Congress being in charge of rewriting the Constitution
yes.
is terrifying.
So why isn't the truth being exposed in these arguments? Why is it that the state legislatures allow these canned arguments to make it seem like, oh, we got to do this or we can't do this without really exposing what would happen if you did it? Or, you know, this delusional, oh, well, if you do it, they're going to be a runaway. The states are going to be run. I'm going to tell you what, if there's going to be a runaway, it's going to be Congress. Right. Congress is going to run away with it.
So why do you think that the Congress hasn't called for a convention that they can manipulate and just rewrite the Constitution to the way their progressive or uniparty ideas are so they can codify it?
Okay, so
what's the danger in them doing that?
Okay, so Article 5 lays it out, because if you look at Article 5 in the enumeration, color-coded enumeration, it's the green part.
Yeah,
or on the application of the legislatures of two-thirds of the states shall call a convention for proposing amendments, which in either case shall be valid it to all intents and purposes as part of this Constitution when ratified by the legislature of three-fourths of the states or by conventions in three-fourths. So in other words, it requires two-thirds of the states before Congress can actually call forth the convention. Because the next line is, as one of the more modes of ratification. So bottom line, Congress has this responsibility to do it. They just can't, you know, say, well, we got three-fourths. Now, there's been arguments that said, hey, if you go back to the very beginning when they started claiming, at least every state has called for a convention once. Isn't that a good enough? No. For the most part, they've kind of been honoring that it has to be of recent conviction. It can't be generational, you know, loss. Those people are dead now. You know, their desire does not exist anymore for that convention. They may have laid it out there and hoped, and in their dying breath go, boy, I wish we would have got that. Nevertheless, at this point in time, I think there is maybe 19 or 20 states that have called forth a convention. So there's still, you know, several states that need to be had to call forth. Folks, it's an absolute waste of time. And the danger is so incredible. Get your state legislature to listen to today's broadcast. Get your legislators to actually hear the fact that the Constitution grants the federal government full control over this convention, regardless of what they said before and how they were going to behave before. Right there, Congress, if they want to change and the states kick back and say you can, it's going straight into the Supreme Court. Why would we risk that? So with that, I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. And we'll be back with these commissions tomorrow. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.